In the last episode, I alluded to the fact that we would be making an episode dealing with star types again. Last episode, we dealt with the regular life cycle kinds of stars, like the supergiants, the main sequence stars. Probably should start with the main sequence stars because they're the most common of them all. The giants, bright giants, supergiants, and hypergiants. I will admit that the only typical stars on that list, though, were the main sequence stars, as the rest of the star types were in no way normal. Like, for example, the red giant, the supergiant, and the hypergiant are not normal stars, but are obviously just moments in a star's life cycle. So it was really more of a life cycle kind of star. In this episode, we will be discussing the white dwarf, the quark star, or actually not the quark star, we'll be discussing only the white dwarf and the neutron star. I will leave links in the description that deal with the quark star, because we literally did not have enough time to actually include the quark star. But of course, if you would like to see a quark star episode, I would be glad to make one. And obviously you can email me with at learningbywilliam@gmail.com if you really want to get an episode on that, because of course I'd contribute an episode on that. But yeah, so I would say the only notable difference in this episode is that these stars are really specifically involved with the deaths of these stars, not with the life cycle stars. Like last chapter's types included the life cycle and not the death of stars, while this episode obviously includes only the dead core remnants of such stars, like the neutron star and the white dwarf star. In this episode, we will discuss both the neutron star and the white dwarf, two types of dead remnant stars of a dead star. So they're not going to be quite life cycle stars anymore. But anyways, without further ado, let us begin to discuss the extreme remnants of the stars in this great universe. In the last chapter, we discussed non-main sequence giants, notably the red giant phase of a typical sun-like star, or just the straight-up giant phase. Technically, it can be like an orange giant, but for the most part, they're red giants. They're cool, large, luminous stars that are essentially the helium-burning remnants of the hydrogen-burning main sequence average low to intermediate mass stars. That we know and love, because the intermediate mass star, in meaning the sun, which is, of course, it's actually a high mass star if you really want to think about the red giants, because the red dwarfs comprise like 90% of the main sequence. But still, it's technically an intermediate star mass, and obviously that's our sun, so it runs everything, literally. So we're particularly fond of this, but the sun itself will once become a red giant. We discussed that in the red giant phase, the old star in a series of helium flashes relinquishes a significant amount of its matter and proliferates a vibrant planetary nebula rich in hydrogen and oxygen, and also carbon, but generally oxygen. Like, if you do astrophotography like I do, when you image planetary nebulas, you want to image an oxygen. If you're doing narrowband, you want to image an oxygen, because you'll get the most data, but also you'll get a lot of data in the hydrogen red portion of the spectrum. So the hydrogen alpha emission line, which is 656 nanometers. But generally you want to go with oxygen, because there's the most oxygen there. And then also in supernova remnants, so like the Veil Nebula, the Crab Nebula, there are many others. I think it's like the Octopus Nebula or something. There's another, or it's a Spaghetti Nebula. There's, that's very oxygen rich. But anyways, this dead remnant of a star once alive is known as a red white dwarf. So basically when in the helium flashes, it just basically loses all its stuff, forms a vibrant planetary nebula. But the dead star, the core of the dead star remains. And of course, this dead remnant of a star once alive is, of course, a white dwarf. So now, if you are more intuitive than I, you may question, how does the white dwarf offset the gravitational pressure that the once alive star offset with radiation pressure? I was thinking about this, and then I was like, oh, What? Like I was very confused because I was like, how does it remain like existing? Like how does it keep itself up beyond the radiation craziness? So it actually has a very weird and odd quantum mechanical method by which it remains stable without collapsing, and this is a very fundamental quantum mechanical principle, literally. It basically, it's something. When the white dwarf first forms, the gravitational pressure it experiences condenses and squeezes electrons into the smallest possible space that they can occupy. At this point, we will need to venture back to into quantum mechanics. So they basically, they accompany, at this point, they accompany the same volume. This is, make sure you listen to what I say when they accompany the same volume because it's important. The Pauli exclusion principle states that no two electrons with the same spin can occupy the same energy state in the same volume. Remember what I said earlier? To go off on another tangent, an energy state ranges from ground to excited or low to high. The ground energy state is the lowest possible state, or if you listened in any of your high school science classes in which you had to draw an atom, it is basically the inner shell of the electron cloud. And the excited state is any state whose energy is higher than a ground state's. So if you imagine a pure untouched uranium atom, which has 792 protons and 92 electrons, you would imagine seven electron shells. The innermost electron shell would be referred to as the ground state, the ground shell, the one with the least amount of energy, whose energy equivalent may be, this is pure example, there's no actual scientific correspondence in this, like 0 electron volts. So it's electrons. That's the energy state. As you proceed to measure greater orbitals, the energy would increase to, for example, like 4 electron volts. Again, not there's no scientific correspondence in this, and then so on. So, like if you went to the seventh, it might be 28 electron volts or whatever it is. So this is basically what an atomic energy state is. Now, I'm often wrong in these episodes, so again, I left many links in the description to explain it better because I know that I am often wrong in this because first of all I'm an amateur 16-year-old doing this by myself and I don't have much time to actually do it but I love doing it. I absolutely love doing it, but I know that I'm going to be wrong often. So that's why I leave all these links in the description so that you guys can look it up yourselves because I'm not going to be right every time. And I know I'm not going to be right every time because even last episode, I realized after making it and after finishing it that I was not right on some of the things I said. They were not necessarily completely wrong, but they were not right. These electrons, according to the Pauli exclusion principle, progress into higher and higher energy states as the lower energy states are filled, thus resulting in the electrons traveling at progressively faster speeds. Now, higher energy, higher kinetic energy, higher speeds. Like they kind of go hand in hand. The increased speeds create a pressure that easily resists the meager gravitational pressure of the subsolar mass white dwarf and creates a stable white dwarf. White dwarfs can still be larger than a solar mass, but not that much larger. The white dwarf should remain a white dwarf as long as it does not accrete mass to the point at which it reaches critical mass and basically documented by the Chandrasekhar limit and becomes a pulsar. I like to imagine Series B, the pup star, like Series A is the dog star, and Series B is the pup star because it surrounds it and it's smaller and like 100,000th as bright. It's a white dwarf with a mass of around 1.018 solar masses and is accreting some, and I mean some, not a lot, very little, mass from its neighboring star, Sirius, or what we know as the dog star, the brightest night star in the entire night sky, and the brightest object that is not in our solar system. As long as there's no supernova going on, and as long as there's no galactic collision or crazy something, whatever going on, or if like a quasar basically migrates to 10 million light years away, like in most cases, yeah, it's the brightest star in the night sky. It's the brightest anything outside of the solar system in the night sky. If it reaches, if specifically the pup star reaches the Chandrasekhar limit, which it almost unequivocally will not, it will experience a type 1a supernova and will become a neutron star. The life cycle of a white dwarf is significantly different from the life cycle of the star in which it once fused stuff into heavier stuff. The white dwarf, which we discussed earlier, does not provide any internal energy or heat through the process of nuclear fusion. So no thermal energy, no kinetic energy, no any energy. I mean, kinetic heat energy is thermal energy is kind of a type of kinetic energy, but I'm not going to talk about that. I didn't really listen in eighth grade physics, but that's a joke. But yeah, it doesn't have any, basically it doesn't have any energy that it supplies to itself. It just kind of just exists. So what might you expect of something like this? The only really method by which it resists gravitational pressure is through electron degeneracy pressure, which we spoke about. So because the electrons are traveling at faster speeds, it creates a pressure that resists the radiation or the gravitational pressure and keeps the star stable. White dwarfs are composed mainly of carbon and oxygen and are very obviously not large enough to be able to fuse those elements, as its parent star itself would not be able to, and was not able to. The white dwarf begins as an exceptionally hot dead core of its parent star, whose temperature can easily reach 100,000 Kelvin. The sun, for comparison, has a surface temperature of 5778 Kelvin, so 100,000 is much greater than 5778. Although this temperature does not exist forever, a white dwarf, as a result of the fact that it does not fuse any elements, will gradually, and does not produce any heat energy, any thermal energy, will gradually cool down from its initial temperature, and once it is cooled down enough, it will become a black dwarf. This cooling is generally believed to take around 15 billion years, and because of the fact that the universe is only 14 billion years old, it is believed that there are only zero existing black dwarfs. There probably are, but we have not discovered any. I mean, there's potential that there is, but it's very unlikely. Like, this is the minimum that it takes, 15 billion years. So it's very unlikely that that is actually the case, that we actually, there are actually black dwarfs and that we don't know about them. It's very unlikely that is the case. In a few billion years, we will be able to see, we'll be able to see them pop up. But for now, they probably do not exist. The current stage in which a white dwarf is in depends entirely on its luminosity, its surface temperature, its level of crystallization. So basically a carbon-oxygen-rich white dwarf crystallizes into diamond and other precious gems as they cool. So literally an old white dwarf is a diamond. Its parent star, so like the now-dead star that formed the planetary nebula, but do not look for the planetary nebula, as they will generally not exist. Well, actually, you could. I mean, you could, technically. Because if you see the planetary nebula, it means that it has not existed for long. So, if you see a planetary nebula, you know that the star, the white dwarf hasn't lived for that long, hasn't existed for long. It has to be under 30,000 years, because the max life expectancy for a planetary nebula is only 30,000 years. So even that beautiful, incredible, cataclysmic, and invigorating, not really cataclysmic, but invigorating planetary nebula we know as the Dumbbell Nebula will not even exist by the time the first humans travel to interstellar space, potentially. It may not even exist because we may not be able to travel to interstellar space for another 10,000 years. It's unlikely that it'll take that long, but even so, if that is the case, then it may be a while, like, it may be a while, and at that point, the beautiful Dumbbell Nebula may not even exist. If a white dwarf is very luminous, it also depends on the white dwarf's surroundings, first of all, and many other factors, but I like to think of it by temperature, or surface temperature, luminosity, level of crystallization, presence of a planetary nebula, surroundings, as in meaning, is it accompanied by another star? Among other things. So if a white dwarf is very luminous, like for example 1/30th as luminous as the sun, and remains much hotter than that of the sun, it can be considered either a young white dwarf or a white dwarf that is an external heat source, so which would be another star. So I would think of Sirius B, the pup star, whose Sirius A, whose parent star, you could say, is essentially giving it matter and keeping it afloat, but it's unlikely that it will keep it alive forever, because Sirius 2 will one day become a white dwarf itself. If a white dwarf is moderately hot, like for example 8,000 Kelvin, which is still 60% hotter than the sun, and is like 1/4,000th as luminous as the sun, I assume, probably something like that, and is not known to have any external heating sources, it can be assumed that it is maturing at around an age of 2 billion years. Once a star, once considered a white dwarf, has a surface temperature of merely a few thousand degrees cooler than the sun, and has a luminosity of around 1/1,000th the brightness of the star, of the sun, and has cooled to the point at which the star itself is a big ball of diamond, it can be considered an elder white dwarf, or in greater depiction, a black dwarf. So a star like this has been a white dwarf for around 15 billion years, and the core of a star for likely around 8 to 10 billion years. So this star is obviously quite old. It is believed that these black dwarfs will be so solidly stable as they are run on quantum mechanical effects that they will exist and persist for the next 10 to the 32,000th power years. If I'm getting this right, but I'm not sure because my meager human brain cannot even comprehend this, I believe this is Google to the Google power to the 3-point-second power. And yeah, I beg you, that's not Google to the Google power, but it's actually, yeah, it is, because that would be 10 to the 10,000th power. Yeah, I believe that's about right. Google to the Google power to the 3-point-second power. So I beg your human mind, because I assume you're a human watching this and not an alien or a robot, I beg you to attempt to understand what Google to the Google to the 3-point-second power is. These white dwarfs will see a lot in their exceptionally brilliant and essentially eternal lifetimes. White dwarfs are relatively uncommon, but still exist in the night sky. While we cannot easily see any white dwarf star, there's some that are visible in the night sky that are not really visible because they're accompanied by something else, or they're just really, really, really dim. Some of them lie under the shadows of our weak eyes, and I'll give you some examples. So, for example, there's a white dwarf in our night sky that includes Ceres B, which a fellow MAS member, Milwaukee Astronomical Society member, and I attempted to observe a few weeks ago. And then also Procyon B, I guess you could say Alpha Beta, Canis Minoris, you could say, something like that. And von Maanen's star. So von Maanen's, I assume it's von Maanen's star. But yeah, so that's everything there is really to know about white dwarfs. There's a lot more to know about white dwarfs, but that is all I can give you on information right now, because that is all I currently do know about white dwarfs. There's probably a little more lying in the shadows of the world, of the shadows of the universe that I do know about, but I don't realize that I know about it, that I did not add in this episode. But I'm sure that's pretty much about it. So next we're going to go to the neutron star. We discussed the white dwarf star, the dead core of a small to intermediate-sized star gone helium flash. The white dwarf is the dead core of an average star, but what question would come to your mind? What is the dead thing that happens? What is the dead core of a massive star? Like, that's basically what I mean to say. And of course, there is a different star classification for the dead core of a massive star, and this one is known as a neutron star, most of them being known as pulsars. But not every pulsar is a neutron star, but not every neutron star is a pulsar. It's like every rectangle is a square, but not every square is a rectangle. I'm saying it right, because I've only heard that thing once. I've only heard that once in my life, and I'm not really sure if that's exactly what it is, but you know what I mean. The neutron star is formed through a very different concept than that of a white dwarf, being that it formed from the core of a massive star. A typical supergiant or hypergiant can fuse far past carbon and oxygen, which is generally the heaviest element that is formed in the core of a typical star. The supergiant can fuse all the way until iron, which is so stable and requires so much energy to fuse that no star can fuse it in its core, no matter how large. It's basically because of how stable it is. Can't easily be fused. It will eventually be fused. It will eventually be fused in the supernova, but that is a different occurrence. Silicon atoms fuse to iron in the core of this massive star until the point at which there is only iron ash, the infusible iron atoms remaining in the core. At this point, the star has less than a second of life left in it. The conclusion of the fusion in the core of the star concludes the radiation pressure that offsets the gravitational contraction that we have discussed in many episodes in the past. And as a result, the core begins to contract again, but this time it is unable to contract enough to fuse iron into heavier elements. Because, as we said earlier, iron cannot be fused in the cores of stars. So every single time that we go up a ring on the ladder, like we go up a step on the ladder, when it comes to the large stars, any star in general, the core has to contract for there to be enough heat and pressure to be able to fuse those elements together. And with iron, it's impossible. So at this point, there's no radiation pressure to offset the contraction of that core, which is above 1.4 solar masses, so it collapses. And as I said in the next sentence, the core of the star instantaneously collapses and releases significant amounts of high-energy gamma rays, which are what, actually, before we get into that, high-energy gamma rays are released into, or are released from the core of the sun as it commits nuclear, as it basically fuses things into other things, and because the photon takes so long to be released, it essentially becomes a it becomes visible infrared and UV light in and of itself, which is odd because obviously the fact that it is released as a gamma ray but becomes visible UV, X-rays or whatever light, but not gamma rays. Gamma rays are a little horrifying, but yeah. And the high-energy gamma rays, there's an interesting thing about them, mind my lisp. These basically break apart the iron atoms in the core themselves, reverting them into helium atoms in a process known as photodisintegration. That's pretty self-explanatory. This photodisintegration continues to revert atoms back to their elementary state. If you don't know what I mean by self-explanatory, photon disintegration. Photon disintegrates an atom. Boom. Photodisintegration continues to revert atoms back to their elementary state, not even as atoms, really. The atoms are basically disintegrated into protons and neutrons, and eventually the protons and electrons that are split apart, and protons and neutrons and electrons, of course, the nuclei of the atoms are disintegrated into protons and neutrons, individual ones, and then the electrons are basically thrown from their shells. But eventually, in this extremely extreme situation, you have a, it's so dense, there's so much pressure that the electrons and the protons are basically forced together, to be forced into protons, or forced into neutrons, not protons. So the protons and electrons literally are combined into neutrons. So now I assume you understand where we get the name neutron star. And the gravitational collapse, we talked about gravitational collapse. It's already reached the Chandrasekhar limit, and the electron degeneracy pressure does not work at the at that limit. So that's the reason why it continues to implode. So like the electron degeneracy pressure does not act against it at that point because there's too much pressure even for that quantum occurrence. So there's another thing that has to be able to keep this star intact. So once this gravitational collapse ceases, it basically will cease in reverse once the core has collapsed so far that it actually exceeds the typical density of protons and neutrons in the core of an atom. And as a result, the strong nuclear force becomes repulsive and actually causes the core of this neutron star to expand. But the thing about this is that the contraction is so great that the strong nuclear force actually does not react in time. So when it contracts so far that it basically, once the strong nuclear force begins to repel it, it expands out again. this expansion that results from that creates massive shock waves that rip the non-neutron star matter apart from the core and causes the thing we all know and love, the core collapse supernova. So that's what happens basically when a star explodes. That's basically what happens. If I were you, I'd go back to 16 and look at the mistake I made, because I believed that it was actually the core collapse that did so, but it was actually a core, in a way, it was almost the opposite of contraction. It was actually the core expansion that caused the shock waves to emanate, to release all that high energy gamma radiation and all the plasma of the star basically everywhere. The remnants of the core of this star is presented as a dead star filled with neutrons and releasing high amounts of electromagnetic energy from its poles, which we know to be the neutron star. A neutron star can also form through a type 1a supernova, which is what we were thinking about with the pup star, which occurs when a white dwarf accretes enough mass and an outside source to reach the 1.4 solar mass Chandrasekhar limit and collapses into a neutron star. Likely the two most distinguishable characteristics of neutron stars include their egregiously great densities and their pulsations of vast amounts of electromagnetic radiation, specifically high energy gamma rays, but pretty much everything else. The neutron star is merely the size of Manhattan, yet it has a mass 1.4 times that of our sun. The white dwarf is around the size of Earth and has about a one solar mass equivalent, but yet this neutron star is condensed down to Manhattan. So just like Manhattan's not that big compared to Earth. If Manhattan was really that big, New York wouldn't really be that that densely populated. The neutron star also emits significant amounts of radiation from its cores, and these pulses can help determine the type of neutron star one is. So we actually have to figure out the types of neutron stars from this, because there are many different types of pulsars or neutron stars. The first of these is the radio pulsar. For most of these types of neutron stars, the name of them is essentially self-explanatory. The radio pulsar emits a significant amount of energy in the radio spectrum, thus giving it the name of a radio pulsar. Radio pulsars are hypothesized to be an origin of the fast radio burst, also known as the FRB, and the first intergalactic FRB discovered is believed to have originated from a neutron star, potentially even from a radio pulsar. Although it is believed that it is originated from a magnetar that emitted an FRB in the radio spectrum, but a magnetar can still be a type of radio pulsar. A subtype of the radio pulsar is a millisecond pulsar, which is a neutron star whose period of rotation is less than 10 milliseconds, or less than that of 1/100th of a second. So it has a very, 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 very fast rotation. So the next one is the magnetar. It is a specific type of neutron star whose magnetic field is significantly stronger than that of an average neutron star. We've discussed this in previous episodes. Any neutron star already has an extremely powerful magnetic field. A magnetar's magnetic field is 1 quadrillion times as powerful as Earth's. And Earth's has the strongest magnetic field of all the rocky planets. So magnetars generally rotate much slower than that of other neutron stars. The magnetar rotates once every 2 to 10 seconds, while other neutron stars often rotate 1 to 10 times per second. Now, if I have this correct, the sun rotates once every 24 days, I believe it is. Think about that. There is a significant difference there. But the magnetar is believed to form from the interactions of two massive binary stars interlocked in an Earth orbit-sized path. The larger of the binary stars begins to secrete its mass for the other, the smaller binary star to accrete, which results in the increased speed of the rotation of the smaller binary star. This smaller binary star, whose rotational velocity is increased noticeably, eventually becomes so massive that it too swaps mass with the star that was once more massive. The smaller of the binary stars becomes small enough that it can support a neutron star and thus a magnetar. So these are extremely massive stars. These are massive stars so massive that they create black holes rather than neutron stars. So their cores not only reach the Chandrasekhar limit, but actually reach the Oppenheimer-Volkoff limit. And the Oppenheimer-Volkoff limit, I believe, is characterized by the fact that the strong nuclear force is not able to repel the gravitational contraction in time that the core is not able to condense and contract down to a black hole. That is my own interpretation of it. It might not be completely correct, but that is what I hear of. The smaller of the binary stars supports this magnetar, and at this point, the extreme magnetic field subtype of the neutron star is born. The last neutron star type to be discussed in this chapter, though most certainly not the only type of neutron star, is the X-ray binary. There are three types, there are other types of neutron stars, but these are the only ones that I could find. But anyways, there are three types of X-ray binaries and one type of X-ray pulsar. There is the low mass X-ray binary, the intermediate mass X-ray binary, and the high mass X-ray binary. And for the X-ray pulsar, the subtype known as the accretion powered pulsar. The X-ray binary is a binary system of a typical star and a neutron star. The low mass X-ray binary occurs with a binary system consisting of a neutron star and a subsolar mass or sun-like star. The intermediate mass X-ray binary occurs with a binary system consisting of a neutron star and a star larger than that of the sun, but not greater than the 10 solar mass mass of a star. And the high mass X-ray binary consists of a neutron star and a star with a mass greater than 10 solar masses. These stars often swap mass with one another, and the neutron star often releases significant amounts of high energy X-rays. So the regular X-ray pulsar that is not powered, that is, that exists, the accretion powered pulsar, that's still powered by accretion. So this doesn't necessarily have to be a star, but this could just simply be an accretion disk. It doesn't necessarily have to be powered by a binary star from what I can recollect of it, but of course I've indicated some links in the description that would explain it better than I do. But they're generally binary stars. They generally occur in binary systems. But anyways, the neutron star is essentially characterized by its general positioning, its rotational velocity and magnetic field strength, and the portion of the spectrum in which it releases the most energy. A stable neutron star will likely continue as it is for over 100 billion years before succumbing to either a black hole or other quantum mechanical processes. And an unstable neutron star may collapse into a black hole and spend the rest of its 10 to the 60th power year lifetime slowly radiating away its matter through Hawking radiation. You can see the episode on black holes for more information. There's little indication that a stable neutron star can exist until infinity, though. But it's potential. There's potential in it. I've seen some indication that there's no possible way that a neutron star can technically lose the rest of its mass, lose the rest of everything, and just become nothing. That it basically lives forever. But from what I'm seeing, it seems as if that's not the case. That it will still exist. But the big thing is, if it reaches the Oppenheimer-Volkoff limit, the 2.3 solar mass limit, like the accretion-powered pulsar, if it reaches 2.3 solar masses, it will become a black hole, a stellar black hole, as they are known. And if it accretes enough mass, and when I mean enough mass, I mean like millions of solar masses of matter, millions of suns of matter, millions of stars, it can be considered a supermassive black hole. Now, I'm not really sure what would be considered to be a supermassive black hole, but I know that it is much larger than a stellar black hole, which is only 2 to 3 solar masses, or well, 2.5 to 3 solar masses, let's just say it that way, 2.3 to 3. Most supermassive black holes are well into the millions. Neutron stars are quite rare themselves, but there are some well-known neutron stars that one may recognize upon hearing of their names. Some notable neutron stars I can think of include the Crab Pulsar, which is the neutron star in the center of the Crab Nebula, Messier 1, which is also the most well-known supernova remnant. Also Calvera, one of the only neutron stars to actually have a real name, and PSR J1748-2446AD. Because they have to say it in the, I assume this is going to be RA deck, so it's a 17-hour, 48-minute RA deck, and it is, I believe that, yeah, and it's negative 24.46 degrees. This would mean that it essentially exists 24 degrees below the celestial equator, or well below the equator, you would say. So 0 degrees directly at the zenith at the equator would be 0 degrees, but 24.46 degrees south at the equator would be negative 24.46 degrees. And then it's 17 hours, 48 minutes from the location of the vernal equinox, so the sun at the eastern horizon. So it's about 6 hours of the night sky behind it. So it's a quarter of the night sky away from technically, it's about a quarter of the night sky away, but behind the sun at that point. So you're probably able to see it during the winter time, Actually, I would say during the wintertime. Well, you'd be able to see it either during the wintertime or the summertime. I can't really think clearly right now. But this is known as the fastest rotating neutron star, which rotates 716 times per second. Obviously, there are more, but many of them have extremely technical names based on entirely on their sky location. But of course, I will leave a link to a list of notable neutron stars so that you can learn more about the wonders of the stars made of neutrons, literally. I did not expect this topic to be divided into two episodes, first of all, because I did not expect this topic to have as much information packed into it as it does. I actually originally planned for like eight different types of stars, and then when I was doing a th when I was doing 1,500 words per star, I knew I was not gonna have enough time to do it. So thus I created two chapters of it. I have not a poetic or dramatic conclusion to this chapter, but I do have the ability to affirm the poetry of the last chapter. Our planet surrounding a highly stable yellow dwarf star in a peaceful suburb of a peaceful galaxy remains surrounded by the hellish, unsurvivable conditions of the daunting universe. Let this chapter be a humbling lesson to you. At best, you can survive at the thin Goldilocks region surrounding a highly stable star, which occupies at best 0.1% of the stars in the universe. Your body is so adapted to the solar system in which you already live that even those 0.1% of stars require perfect conditions for you to survive for merely a second in its habitable zone. You're incredibly lucky to be in such a perfect place for your own existence, so cherish it while you have the time to exist within it. Anyways, thank you all for listening, and as always, have a good morning, afternoon, evening, and night. This is a new thing, but if you would like to support this podcast, you can click the link in the description of my podcast and give your support. The money will help me pay for the egregious costs of 12 years of college. I'm going into astrophysics, so I will need a lot of money to be able to pay for that. But anyways, take care and stay curious. Have a good night, everyone.